This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Drug overdose is now the leading cause of accidental death in the United States, and that surpasses automobile crashes. And in North Carolina, the overdose death rate is higher than average. Most overdoses come from abusing prescription pills like opiate-based OxyContin and morphine. Last year, about 500 people in North Carolina died from unintentional prescription pill overdoses. And Wilkes County had, for a time, one of the worst records in the state. But 4 years ago, Fred Brayson gave rural Wilkes County a second chance when he started Project Lazarus. The project works to educate doctors and addicts on the dangers of pill abuse, and it helps to distribute a new drug to reverse overdoses. Fred Brayson joins us now on the State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Paint the picture of Wilkes County in terms of deaths by drug overdose of 7 or 8 years ago.
Actually, my first was brought to my attention back in 2004 through I was the director of hospice, and we were finding, you know, medication issues with the patients in their homes. We don't have a hospice house, so all of our patients were in their homes. But, you know, medication was disappearing, family members stealing it, some family members sharing it, some selling it, to the point where I had prescribers telling me they could no longer safely write a prescription to that house. Then I had an access to care issue. So that's when I started to ask questions, and with my home health background and all that, I'd seen some of this, you know, for years, but very few, very, very minimal. So this was kind of like, this is way over the top, and that's when I started to ask questions and then soon realized, you know, the situation in Wilkes and how bad it really was, to the point in 2007, as you alluded to, we were the third worst county for overdoses from prescription medications in the country.
And the country had by then risen to – the overdoses in the country had become a chronic problem.
Yes. You could see the rise starting in the early 2000s, and then, you know, it's still escalating, unfortunately.
So what you pointed to was illegal drug use by and large. These are people who are taking these drugs and using them illegally. But a lot of the problem is also people who are misusing drugs that are prescribed for them, right?
Correct. Yes. That we you know, there's a – in looking at the people that were overdosing, I desire to look at the who, what, when, where, and how did that occur. You know, patients misusing, family members self-medicating with another family member's or friend's medication. And then, of course, those that, you know, have substance use disorder, addiction issues, or just recreationally not realizing that it doesn't take much, you know, to overdose from something that was actually prescribed to somebody else.
Substance abuse is not new in the United States. Drug overdoses, particularly for drug abusers, is not new. What accounts for this rise in overdose death and it overtaking accidental death by traffic accident?
Well, a lot of it has to do with this phenomenon started in the rural areas of America, you know, in the early 2000s, primarily when you look at the history of where the overdoses have occurred. But when you look at, again, you know, who has overdosed, you know, what the prescribing levels are, you know, and there is a correlation between the increase in prescribing and the increasing in overdoses, though we can't really say that that's definitively a cause, but there is a correlation. Part of that has to do with, you know, rural America, you know, chronic pain issues, a lot of labor intensive work. And then here was, you know, opioid medications available that weren't previously so widespread. Where individuals who wouldn't do cocaine, wouldn't do heroin, suddenly here was a prescribed medication, and if a prescriber prescribed it, it's okay. You know, and that's a perception that needs to change, but that's essentially cemented in part of the problem.
And another thing that, in a sense, made it okay was the time when pain itself became a kind of vital sign, one of the things that everybody asked about when they made their rounds.
Right. And that's why if anybody's been into an emergency room, they're going to see the 10 frowns and smileys on the wall, because back in the late 1990s, it was pretty much mandated to the practitioner community to ask that question, you know, what's your weight, you know, your blood pressure, all of that. But then are you in pain? And then, of course, once you say yes, then it comes down to, all right, where? And then on a scale of 1 to 10. And then as soon as that occurs, then, all right, how am I going to treat this? If there's no other modality but relieving your pain through a prescription, then that's what you received.
Were you surprised to see this increase in sort of rural folks taking care of it, in your case, a hospice in hospice care, stealing these drugs, using these drugs in these areas?
Oh, I was totally shocked, you know, because I had never experienced that before. You know, my years growing up, I never even thought once of going into my parents' medicine cabinet and looking for what was there and taking anything. It would just never even cross my mind. So to see this, you know, was you know, it caught my attention, which, again, asking the questions back in 2004 and 5 and 6, nobody had any answers. And many people said, what problem? You know, it just hadn't hit the radar screens yet of the issues. But thankfully for among some, it was. And then that's when we decided, well, if nobody has an answer, we have a problem. We're going to have to figure out how to fix it ourselves.
And the solution in your case was Project Lazarus. Tell us about that.
Yeah, as we looked at the issues and who needed to be involved and the folks that unfortunately were dying from overdose or emergency department visits or hospitalizations, you know, not everybody's dying, thankfully, but there's still issues out there. We realized it was all population groups, all ages. There was no – there's no ethnicity to this. There's no race. There's no income. It affects everybody. Then we realized we've got to address it through our village, our community, because we have to change the individual's thoughts and behaviors regarding prescription medications. That's going to take influence, you know, in every aspect of their lives. So if somebody's a senior citizen and they're seeing, going to the senior center, they're hearing a message. If somebody is being arrested and there's crime and there's addiction, law enforcement can become engaged and get that person into help. So we worked with hospital, emergency department, health department, youth groups, you know, faith community, just bringing everybody up to speed on the problem, but asking three questions or answering three questions, I should say. Why am I needed? What needs to be done? And then what do I need to do?
Was it a tough sell when you started to go to hospitals, to healthcare providers, for instance? I mean, it's one thing to say, we've got a problem with drug abusers. These people are using illegal drugs. They're sitting in the park shooting up heroin. That's a whole universe that you're going to have to deal with, mostly criminal justice, right?
Right.
But when you go to the providers and say, you're part of the problem here, you didn't mean to be, but actually you're part of the problem, what was their response?
Well, we went in without any kind of the blame game. You know, we went in with, here is the problem. You know, it is psychosocial. You know, it is general practice. It's all of those things, but we can all change our practices to try and fix the problem. So as we looked at that, we helped physicians, prescribers at every level, nurse practitioner, physician's assistant, whomever that may be, in bringing them tools to assess patients, bringing them tools on how to manage chronic pain, how to treat acute pain, and be aware of the individual's maybe tendency, whether it's environmentally, whether it's biologically, aspects of addiction, misuse, abuse, what's going on in the home, you know, what kind of environment is Wilkes County? Well, it's moonshine, you know, it's all of that. And again, here you're talking about something that everybody views as legal. So it's just kind of rolling things back. Let's start over again, you know, but we don't want you to stop prescribing. We want you to see these individuals, but let's just make sure that it's done safely.
We're talking about ways to reduce the number of deaths caused by drug overdose today on The State of Things. Fred Brayson is with me. He is the director and the founder of Project Lazarus in Wilkes County. So what kind of things changed?
Well, it took 2 years to even bring the public aware that there was a problem, you know, because most weren't – they were either in denial or totally unaware. But so we kind of went sector group by sector group by sector group, and then here's the data. Here's the reality, you know, that no, it's 20 deaths. It's 25 deaths. It's 31 deaths just from our neighborhoods. You know, and in a small community, that begins to resonate, you know. And then when the emergency department is full of individuals who are having, you know, effects or drug seeking, you know, and all of those issues, that starts to get everybody's attention. And that's when we started, okay, now you're aware of the problem. We don't need to talk about the problem. We need to form the solutions. And when we started to work out solutions kind of sector group by sector group, they became energized because it actually – there is something I can do.
Well, what did they do? I mean, it's interesting because now this, you're saying you're discovering this for the first time. You're revealing to yourselves the scope of this problem, but there are no solutions at this point because the problem is now just being discovered. What kinds of solutions did they come up with?
Well, the prescribing community, you know, being more careful, more surveillance, more monitoring, you know, more assessment, tying them together with behavioral health and addiction treatment folks within the community so that there's a referral mechanism and a networking for those individuals. Moms and dads in their homes, educating them on, you know, don't just leave the drugs out on the medications out on the table. You know, yeah, you might trust your kids, but what about their friends? You know, what, you know, remove the temptation. And then, of course, getting rid of your medications. And we've always said, you know, medications, you take it correctly, store securely, dispose properly, and never share. Now, that's unusual. We don't do that. We take it as needed. Storing it, no, it's out there so we remember to take it. And sharing it's common because, oh, I want to help you. Oh, your back's hurting? Well, here, I have some pain meds that I had for my tooth, you know, not realizing, you know, the dangers, you know, of doing that. So as we began to educate and then in that changing behaviors and thought process, that started to bring about some change in what people did every day. And that started to tighten the supply, you know, the access to what normally was easily obtained. And then we realized we better have a strong safety net for people who have had it that shouldn't have, who might need help. And then we started to build that process. So that was a change in creating more avenues for treatment and care and recovery support services.
And then the drug Naloxone, which reverses the effects of the overdose. Tell us about that.
And that's something I learned about in 2006 and 7. Never heard of it before. Didn't need to, thankfully. But, you know, it came to my attention that Naloxone, which the trade name was Narcan, it was created in like 1971. It reverses an opioid overdose by kicking the opioid off the brain receptor, that if there's too much on there, your brain stops telling your body to breathe, and you basically stop breathing and die from an overdose. This drug comes in and kicks it off for 30 to 90 minutes so that you automatically begin breathing again. It's got a miracle drug, literally, in the sense of giving it to somebody. But EMS has it, and emergency departments have it. And my first question, being a logical thinker, well, my neighbors died in their home. Mm. Why don't people have this if they can't abuse it? It's got no other use. If you gave it to me and I don't need it, it's like water. But if I do need it, you saved me.
There are objections, however, and some controversy surrounding that drug, and we will talk about those and other aspects of Project Lazarus on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Fred Brayson, Project Lazarus, is talking to us about prescription pill abuse in North Carolina, and you're listening to the State of Things on North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about drug overdose deaths in the state of North Carolina, one of the highest in the country, and the nation's death rate from overdose has now surpassed traffic accidents as the highest rate of accidental death in the country. We're also talking about a new drug called Naloxone. It is changing the game. Last year, about 500 people in North Carolina died of unintentional prescription pain overdoses. We've been talking with Fred Brayson, the founder of Project Lazarus in Wilkes County. Joining us now is economics professor David McAdams. He specializes in game theory and has written about prescription drug seeking in hospitals. His recent book is called Game Changer, Game Theory and the Art of Transforming Strategic Situations. Welcome, David. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us briefly, so what does game theory have to do with drug seeking and then, by extension, drug overdose?
Well, game theory, Frank, is the study of strategic interactions. And what that means is a game is any situation where there's more than one person or party making decisions. And medicine is rife with games. In particular, pain is a game in the sense that to be treated for pain, the patient interacts with the doctor. The doctor prescribes something. You go to the pharmacist. Some drugs are diverted illegally, in which case criminals are now part of the game. Okay, so we can use game theory to think about this strategic ecosystem, why we have the problems we have, and what are kind of the key levers that if we pulled them, we might change the game for the better.
So what have you found in terms of – well, let me ask you a different question, because you heard Fred talk about the fact that somewhere in the late 90s or early 2000s, mid-90s was it, that pain became essentially a vital sign.
The fifth vital sign.
The fifth vital sign. So now it really is present in your mind and the practitioner's mind in a way that it hadn't been before that. Does that make it a kind of a rule and change the game?
Oh, exactly. So this shift in pain management – was a really important change with this unintended consequence. So it seemed like a game changer in a positive sense, because pain itself is still extremely undertreated. I mean, we're talking about people getting too much pain medication. There's also millions of people who are probably getting too little, who suffer from this. However, now what we've done by treating pain as the fifth vital sign is we've changed the game, if you will, of the relationship between the physician and the patient. So now the physician's default is to give you a strong pain medication, even a narcotic, and that can sometimes lead people to become dependent.
And this is because, and maybe Fred, I'll direct this question to you, but it's not just to relieve the pain, but it can also help in sort of getting better. It's therapeutic in the sense that if you're struggling with pain, some of the other symptoms and the center of this disease may last longer. I can help you your cure time if I can relieve the pain.
Absolutely. And any of us that have been in pain for any reason, injury or otherwise, realize that that becomes our focus. And then our energy goes into trying to alleviate that pain in some way, somehow. So that when it is alleviated through, you know, medication, then obviously all the other symptoms and all the other issues, or whether it's emotional, psychological, and physical, then can be easily addressed because, you know, you've eliminated something that was a target and the focus point.
Problem is that this is all, as you say, relationship and very subjective. And you're talking to a person who has all of the anxieties and the difficulties of dealing with whatever brought them to the hospital. And now you're asking them this very subjective question.
Right. So there's that issue that it's difficult to assess pain. But there's a broader issue as well that pain management needs to be coordinated care. As Fred pointed out, there's all sorts of specialists need to be brought to bear to treat people properly. And I just wanted to take a moment to shout out to the Duke Pain Medicine Center, which is taking a new coordinated approach to this. I'm sure you'll probably have another show on that some other time. But that's an important way to not just improve care, but to also gain some control over these narcotics. Because if they're being prescribed properly, if people don't feel the need to go get more to get them illegally, or through some other way to steal from their grandparents, then we can focus on getting these medications to those who need them, and we have less of them floating around. So ultimately, the root of the solution is going to be in the relationship between the physician and the pain patient.
Although one of the things, Fred, one of the problems we know from addiction is that you continually lower your threshold, your tolerance for discomfort and pain. So is there a right amount once we begin, you know, sort of taking painkillers? How advanced is the science in knowing where that point is?
Well, the efficacy of opioid pain relief medication for long term is still not sufficiently studied. And the FDA and others, you know, have agreed that there needs to be more study about long-term use. We know that it is effective for pain, but over time, somebody needs more of the medication because the tolerance level within their body changes so that the pain – it takes more medicine to lessen the pain. Now, if we're going to go from the premise in the game that you have the right to be pain-free – then you're going to continue to need medication and probably more medication. If we go on the premise that instead of looking at it from 1 to 10 on the pain scale, how can you function? You know, if you're at a 3 and you were at an 8 and you can function normally at 3, then let's stay at that baseline rather than trying to feed everything to get you to zero pain level. And create more problems possibly.
And so, David, one of the problems that this has created is drug seeking, and now hospitals, as particularly ERs, are becoming more in clinics, much more aware of this, and they're on the lookout for it. When you say there, in fact, are databases that could help clinicians determine what's going on here, right?
Yeah, there's a really important development across the United States. Essentially, every state now has or is coming on online with what's called a prescription drug monitoring program. You can think about this as a database of all narcotic painkiller prescriptions. So if I go to the emergency room with a problem and I get such a prescription, say I go to Duke first because I am a Duke professor.
You're a Duke professor. I have to point that
then,
out. It's the second time that's come up. So
but
UTC,
then I go to the UNC emergency room, okay? So I then can claim I have the same toothache I claim to have at Duke. If they, you know, push the button and check, they will see that 30 minutes ago I was somewhere else, and they will know that I should be denied. So if we can make it easy for emergency physicians and also others who are involved in the process of prescribing these medicines, if this becomes routine to check it, and if these doctors have appropriate incentives to do so, then that could be a part of the solution.
Do you know if it is becoming routine?
Well, the problem that I explore, you know, in the chapter in my book is that many emergency physicians do not check the database. And I think there's lots of reasons for that are hard to understand. It's a puzzle until you put yourself, I think, in the shoes of an emergency physician. You have a lot of people who desperately need your help. You have a person who comes in, says they're in pain. to deny them drugs is going to take a lot of time. There might be a chance that you're wrong and they do need it. So there's a natural tendency to err on the side of caution. But knowing that, people who want drugs they shouldn't have, they come and get them.
We also talk about incentives. We would think it's obvious what the incentive is, but you also talk about the need to make it more clear to doctors that this is an important priority.
Yeah, the problem that I think hospitals need to pay more attention to is that right now emergency departments and emergency physicians are given a perverse incentive to make sure that people who come to the emergency room are, quote, satisfied with their experience. When you go to the emergency room, you go to survive. Whether you are satisfied is secondary. And unfortunately, if a sizable percentage of the people going are seeking narcotics, the only way to satisfy them is to give them drugs they shouldn't have. So this is a perverse incentive. Hospitals should change the way they incentivize their own doctors to encourage them to deny, to A, check the database, and B, deny drugs to those who are red flagged. It's really as simple as that. And I'm an optimist, and I believe that if this can be brought to the attention of high enough levels in hospital management, it's a fairly simple solution. And it could. And I should say, this is also going to help hospitals' bottom line, because let's say you're the only hospital to adopt such a practice in an area. Those who are seeking drugs will quickly learn by experience and by telling each other, hey, you know, Duke's not a good place to get your drugs. Go to some other place. You'll now have less people crowding your emergency room. You'll be able to provide a better quality, better experience to those who do come, who actually do need your help.
And perhaps spend less time trying to sort out whether this is a drug seeker.
And it's not just time. It's an emotional experience that every emergency physician I've talked to, this weighs on them. I mean, just think about it. If you go home at night and there's a few people you had a conflict with, or you made a choice that you think might have been the wrong choice, you're worried they might have died. Okay, so this is something that weighs on emergency physicians emotionally. So it really matters to them. And as well as the patients.
Naloxone, we talked about, is a drug that, as you said, when you go to the emergency room, you're going to survive. That has improved the survival rate, Fred. Tell us again how this works, because it has also the effect of throwing the individual directly into an overdose situation, but
withdrawal.
Right. And I mean, if you're on opioid medication, whether for pain or whether because you have, you know, addiction issues, and you are overdosing from that medication and naloxone is given, it obviously reverses the overdose very, very quickly. If you were a consistent user, you are going to have withdrawal symptoms immediately. If you were in pain, you're back in pain. You know, so it's very uncomfortable, but the alternative is you would have been dead. You know, so for that 30, 60, 90 minutes of being uncomfortable, for most, it's obviously worth it that it was available. And that was our goal in Wilkes, was we have to get this into the right people's homes, hands, circumstances, environment in order for it to be utilized, because we're in an epidemic that's man-made, you know, and then we've got to have it isn't just a vaccine that we can provide out there to fix all of this. It's multifaceted, and naloxone is a key component of that to ensure that we can reverse the overdose.
Seems like a miracle drug, and obviously you would want to have it, but there is a kind of moral hazard that's attached to this, at least in the minds of some, that has created controversies in some circles and made it somewhat more difficult in some places to get naloxone into every emergency room and into every clinic. People carry naloxone. Sometimes police officers have decided that would be a good idea as well. Carrboro Police Department did announce that its patrolling officers will carry naloxone. And joining us now to talk about that is Patrol Captain of the Carrboro Police, Chris Atak. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the decision to ask officers to carry naloxone.
Well, we were approached the spring of this year by the Orange County Health Department and the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. Kind of went to a meeting where all the law enforcement agencies in Orange County got together and were presented kind of some of the realities of what we're seeing with both prescription drug abuse and opiate abuse in general, talking about some of the risks, talking about naloxone and policies related to Project Lazarus efforts, as well as the Quincy, Massachusetts Police Department's program, whereby their officers carry naloxone. So we sat there and we listened to the trends and the numbers and started to kind of absorb it as a concept. So I came back to our agency. We sat down with the chief. We all kind of put our heads together and said, you know, if you look, if you give this a hard look, it's so blatantly a good idea. Like, it almost slaps you in the face. And I'm talking, you know, you look at the numbers, you look at the potential, you look at the chance that an officer, a frontline officer, could have an immeasurable impact in a situation like this, simply because we made an initial investment of under $700 and trained them for an hour every year. We had to check it because it was just so obvious to us that it was a good idea.
As I said, it seems obvious, but there are challenges and there is a critique, and that is that by letting it be known, by making it public, that there is this antidote, a thing that can save you from the worst. As a drug addict, it is now a kind of moral hazard. I can now enter more freely into my abuse because I know I can be spared from this. So just in terms of game theory, David, let me start with you.
Let me just say this is a misunderstanding. I mean, I don't have any dog in this hunt. I looked into the scientific literature on this some. This particular question has been studied. They looked at heroin addicts who were given access to naloxone along with training and some education on how to use it and when to use it. Those people used less heroin. It is not true that giving people access to naloxone and providing training on its appropriate use will increase, this misuse of these drugs. It's just there's no evidence for it, and there is evidence against that claim. So this notion that it's going to cause more addicts is incorrect, and we already heard why. Right. Because it feels horrible to take this drug. You're revived, and you first thing you say is, please kill me. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Fred can probably tell you war stories.
Well, those are the facts. But the perceptions are powerful in a political universe. And I wonder if you had to work through those within the police department. Did it come up?
It's interesting. We kind of discussed this before we had the training. And Orange County Emergency Services, EMS, provided the training to us on the use and the signs and symptoms, et cetera, that would suggest that naloxone use was appropriate. And so in the training, we actually talked that. We said, look, this is weird. This is a little strange. You know, this may be a concept that you cannot absorb today. And so what I said was, focus on learning the skills in this training session. Let the idea percolate. Let it sit there and think about. Walk away from this training with the skills. And, you know, it's natural that some people, you know, you have early adopters. You have people who are late adopters. You have somewhere in the middle. We have the gamut. We are people, too. So you had officers that are like, what in the world? You know, this doesn't, what? You know, it blurs the line. It's, you know, we're now becoming EMS. We're going to drive fire trucks. We're going to, you know, we're going to have stretchers in the back. And it, you know, to me and to the assessment that we looked at was the use of naloxone and the training on it is very much equivalent to other emergency medical procedures that law enforcement would be involved in, CPR. All of our officers have traumatic injury kits, tourniquets, blood clotting agents, compression bandages to provide self-care, buddy care, etc. So naloxone fits very nicely into that overall program within our agency personally, but it's an absorption. You have to think about it. One of the survivability factors for law enforcement is kind of the coping mechanism that you skill is you put everybody in a box. And sometimes when we put somebody in a box, it can be difficult to pull them out. And I think that's one of the honest discussions you have to have in this training to say, you might stick this person. You may only see this person who's addicted to drugs. You may only say, they're a drug addict, they're in this box. But you have to rehumanize that person and say, that is somebody's dad, mom, brother, sister. I was an investigator for 9 years. I investigated heroin overdose deaths. I've investigated UNC students who were dead as a result of accidents or intentional overdoses. I've seen it. It doesn't make it easier. That is a human being, and they have parents, and they have a family. And it's very much a human services issue. And traditionally, law enforcement has looked at drug addiction as a law enforcement issue. Other countries see it as a medical issue. And I think that's the paradigm shift, that this starts with law enforcement. So you have to have that frank discussion. You have to, no pun intended. Yeah. You have to have that discussion because there are people in law enforcement that will be uncomfortable with it. That's not our job. We don't do that. Why would we do this? But having that discussion, hearing people out, saying, we understand what you're saying, but this, I mean, I've had officers after our training approach me and say, you know, I've thought about it. I cannot imagine what it would feel like to bring somebody back from the dead.
Has anybody used it? Let me interrupt.
We are not carrying it yet. We're still waiting for the red tape to be sliced on all accounts.
Fred?
In regards to that, because I've talked with other law enforcement agencies, and that first save, so to speak, just lights up the department. But I'll never forget the, you know, because we've been distributing and dispensing naloxone in Wilkes County for, you know, a number of years now, and obviously other areas. But the first time I got the message, you know, that it had been used, and a brother had his kit. He had gotten it because he was in addiction treatment. And getting an addiction treatment, he was given naloxone on enrolling in that treatment because of on-again, off-again issues. His sister was overdosing. And he called the clinic, and the clinic said, call 911, get your kit, and spray it in her nose and use it. And he did, and he saved his sister's life. 4 days later, she was in treatment.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. I wish we had more time. Fred Brayson is the founder of Project Lazarus in Wilkes County. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. Appreciate you me being here.
Chris Atack is a police captain at the Carrboro Police Department. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And David McAdams is an economics professor at Duke, I think. Is it Duke?
I'm pretty sure.
Duke University. He's the author of the book Game Changer. It's a book about game theory, and it's a wonderful book as well. See, and I don't even go to Duke, and I said something nice about your book. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the attention to this important problem.
Coming up next, we're going to take a look at comedy in Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned.